Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the classic French feast in danger of extinction? Where would you go to find all the ingredients and the people with the skills to prepare and serve them flawlessly? John Baxter has made his home happily in Paris for more than two decades, so you can imagine his dismay a few years ago when he realized that restaurants there were taking shortcuts, using canned and pre-sauced and boil-in-a-bag ingredients. Convenient and economical, sure, but that sort of food would have been almost unrecognizable to the venerable chef and writer Auguste Escoffier. So Baxter resolved to put together a menu of classic foods worthy of Escoffier and set about traveling all over the country to taste examples of each dish. He shares the delightful journey and a lot of fascinating history in his book, The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
So you took a friend to eat at the Grand Palais. Talk about the sort of experience one is led to expect there based on the atmosphere.
Well, yes, it's an extraordinary place, as you may know. It's in a turn-of-the-century building, very much built in the 18th century style, enormous columns with all sorts of decoration, statues, things like that. And we were sitting there enjoying our meal, and literateur and I, and we were served, in my case, an asparagus soup topped with a pansy. And I thought, this is absurd. Here we are eating like Roman emperors, and we're eating pansies and baby hamburgers and things like that. And I thought, what we should be having, you know, is something lavish, and it should, somewhere in the background, there should be some slaves roasting an entire ox. That would be more in keeping with the surroundings. So I thought, I'm going to see if there are places where the great dishes are still served, are still cooked, and hopefully I can end the whole search with officiating at the roasting of an ox. And in the end, I was able to do this.
So why is it that kind of big, ambitious, traditional French cooking is not so easy to find in Paris, of all places, these days?
Well, money comes into it, as it usually does with anything to do with restaurants. The great restaurants of the 19th century were big because they catered to large groups of people. It was quite usual to celebrate a baptism or the first communion with a feast for 20 people, 30 people. A marriage, of course, you take over the whole restaurant. We don't do that these days. It's just too expensive. So restaurants have shrunk. They're much smaller in terms of the number of people they can seat. Also means they have fewer people in the kitchen. And of course, that means that corners are cut. What really shook me was visiting one of these huge professional food supermarkets that ring Paris, and you're only allowed in if you're a professional. I went in with a friend, and instead of having shopping carts, these people have six-wheeled steel platforms, which they load up with enormous cans of confit de canard, great slabs of foie gras, pre-prepared potatoes, pre-prepared vegetables, frozen, boil in a bag, canned, microwavable, what they call cuisine en kit, kit food in the trade, and it was an eye opener.
And can you taste the difference when you sit down to a meal like that?
Oh yes, for heaven's sake! You know how it is. It's like eating Thanksgiving turkey at home that's been lovingly prepared by mum with the dressing that you remember from when you were a kid, and surrounded by your friends. Of course, it tastes so much better. And as soon as I got out of Paris and started to travel around France, eating in the regions, the difference was striking, really. I realized that what I'd been eating in Paris was just a pale shadow of what great cooking can be.
So let's talk about this. A few years ago, UNESCO actually spotlighted the gastronomic meal of the French as a cultural treasure worthy of preservation. And in doing so, they dared to define what that meant. What did UNESCO conclude must be present?
It's a bit complicated. Typical of UNESCO, you know, it's sort of taking a hammer to a nut. Basically, they were talking about what we call the repas, the repast, the great meal, the meal that was meant to celebrate and to mark an occasion. Mm-hmm. So automatically, it meant a lot of people, something between 10 and 20 people. It would have meant sort of 8 to 10 dishes. There would have been a starter, and there would have been a dessert, of course. There would have been a fish dish. There would have been a meat dish. There would have been digestives, aperitifs. There would have been cheese, of course. A meal without cheese is like a day without sunshine, as they say here. And between each course, there probably would have been toasts drunk to the particular guests. There would have been the appropriate wines, of course, and the whole thing would have been presided over by what they call a gastronome. That is somebody who was an expert in food, in the appreciation of food, and in the appropriate conversation that should go on when food was being eaten. So it's a tall order for your average corner restaurant, I'm afraid.
And even the definition is something that no actual French chef worth his or her salt would have even tried to attempt.
It would have been a very courageous chef who did it. In fact, I was just talking today with an American friend who decided to get married and looked around for a restaurant that could cater for 30 people, and he finally had to go outside Paris to a restaurant run by a friend of his, where they had enough room to accommodate him. And then he and the chef sat down and worked out a program for the meal within his price range, and keeping in mind the tastes of the guests, which is exactly what you would have done with a great chef like Escoffier 100 years ago. You would have consulted with him, the gastronome, about the form of the repas. It was just understood. Now it's unknown practically.
So you look to your friend Boris to serve as a sort of mentor, your personal gastronome, is that right?
Well, that's right, yes. I call him Boris. It's not his real name. But he he has a cultivated palate, so cultivated that he hardly ever eats, in fact. I describe in the book how I first met him, because we were facing one another at a large formal dinner where the food had obviously come out of bags and been warmed up in the microwave, and he just had an empty plate, but he mimed eating an entire meal, knife and fork, cutting imaginary food, drinking imaginary wine, even taking a piece of bread to mop up imaginary gravy. And at the end of, after I'd watched him for a while, thinking, I'm really not seeing this, he leaned over to me and winked, and he said, I'm on a diet.
So he was obviously someone that could point you in the right direction and sort of knew where to look for the best tastes within Paris, and I guess he knew who to hook you up with outside the city.
Yes. Well, between us, we did. I have my connections. I have my favorite butcher, my favorite fishmonger, my favorite supplier of fruit and vegetables. But he was the person who guided me towards the great dishes that I should think about. For instance, bouillabaisse, which is the great seafood stew of the Mediterranean. Well, I wanted to include this, but he was the one who suggested that I should go down to Sète, right on the Mediterranean, eat it in the place, in fact, where I first ate it many years ago. And it was something of a disappointment, I'm afraid, because they no longer make bouillabaisse as they should in the traditional way. So I raked through my memory for that original dish and reconstructed it with his help. And the recipe appears in the book in a form that one can actually cook it in one's home.
I've wondered, John, over the years about the importance of place and setting in making a meal really special. Some of the meals I remember as the best I've eaten in my life happened to have been in places I had never been to before. And I don't know if I was just overwhelmed by the experience or if I happened to luck into sitting down to a really phenomenal meal the first time.
Yes, place comes into it. Certainly it does for me. When I lived in the United States, I taught in Virginia for a few years, and I loved going out to small country restaurants and eating real barbecue, eating real ribs, tasting some of the dishes that are really unknown in Europe. That was an extraordinary experience. And when I came to live in France, I found the same thing, that to go, for instance, as I describe in the book, to go to Bergerac, which is down in the foie gras country, and eat a real rarity like lamprey, which is a rather strange thing, looks like an eel but tastes like sardines, and has to be cooked in a particular way in its own blood. It was not so much the dish, which, to tell the truth, somewhat underwhelmed me, but the way in which we were entertained by some family friends in their farm, which is on a hilltop over Bergerac. We sat under a huge tree, ate foie gras, drank Mont Basilic, which is a local cold white wine. That was as memorable to me as the lamprey.
What about the time of meals in France? We hear a lot in the U.S., you know, we kind of, as you well know, we gulp down our meals here and sort of move on. And the idea is that overseas people wait longer and take longer. Is that at risk as well, do you think, in France?
Not so much. You're quite right. I could never get used to the fact that people in the United States sort of sit down to dinner at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. In France, as you know, more like 9 o'clock. But though some, a very few restaurants have introduced two seatings, that's very rare. You really, if you go to a restaurant at 9 o'clock, you can expect to be there still at midnight. There's none of this closing down the kitchen at 10 o'clock. You are allowed to enjoy your meal and to have a few digestives. And of course, traditionally in France, if it's a business meal, you do not talk business until the end of the meal, as they say, between the pear and the cheese. That's when you talk turkey. So you can't truncate a meal in Paris if you're a serious eater or you're a serious business person. You have to let it run its course. So the restaurants that do well only have a single seating each night, but you begin much later than you do in other countries.
Is there any secret in these big meals with lots of courses, lots of drinks, to not becoming intoxicated before the pears and cheese arrive?
Oh, it is a risk, I know. You do have to pace yourself, I think. You can't sort of wash down things with wine. What you do is you always have water. Mm-hmm. The water is always served with the wine, and you sip the wine and you gulp the water. And that way you can appreciate the wine without actually using it to sort of wash things down and to slake your thirst. I think that's the trick. The real danger lies when they bring out the digestives, which are the cognac, the Calvados, all of the strong alcohol drinks. They can really knock you about.
Author John Baxter is with us. His new book is called The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author John Baxter about his new book, The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, I've actually been to France only once, and now that I read your book, I realize I committed all sorts of errors all over the country ordering my beverages, because it turns out there are some pretty robust, unspoken rules about what you drink and when.
Yes, it's true. There are difficulties about what you should drink, some things you should avoid. One of my favorite problems I face with English people is they order a beer, not realizing that there is another drink that sounds just like that, but spelt B-Y-R-R-H, which is a sort of liqueur slightly flavored with violets. And sometimes they get a nasty shock. Some things sneak up on you. Some of the stronger brandies are a bit hard to take. And, of course, there's absinthe, which was illegal for a long time because poisonous. Now it's drunk more, but it's still tricky to find the right brand. And then, of course, with wines, you know, it's a jungle. You can very easily spend a lot of money on some very bad wine and, by the same token, find on the supermarket shelves extremely drinkable wine. So you do need a guide, really, I think, is the best thing. Or ideally somebody who likes to eat and drink as well as you do, and then you discover things more or less together. I did that with my wife. Marrying a French woman was one of the best things I ever did, because she has a very cultivated palate and was able to educate me, for instance, in drinking Bordeaux, which has become my favorite tipple.
And it was your wife who showed you that in France, when you have good caviar, the meal becomes an event.
Ah, caviar. Ah, yes. There's a whole chapter, as you know, about caviar. That was marvelous. When I first met her, she confessed to me that this was her guilty secret, that she loved caviar. And I'd never eaten it. I came from Australia. You know, we didn't believe in things like caviar. I'd never even actually seen it. You know, I'd seen pictures of it, but I'd never seen it. And so, as I describe in The Perfect Meal, just after I moved to Paris, I was passing through Heathrow Airport, and I noticed that in the seafood bar they had caviar, cans of caviar, for sale. So I brought one back, and my wife insisted on delaying the tasting until the weekend, when we could really savor it. And then she got out her grandparents' best china, a special spoon to serve the caviar, because you never serve it with metal. You have to use an organic spoon, and she had one made out of deer horn. Hmm. And then she got out the special grandmother's glasses, and I got a bottle of vodka, which I'd kept in the freezer, so it was barely pourable. And then we opened up the caviar and put it on warmed blinis with just a touch of creme fraiche, and downed a gulp of vodka, and then ate the caviar. And I thought, now I understand.
Now you're living.
Yeah, exactly.
You actually discovered that there is some caviar produced in France.
Yes, this surprised me. Prunier's, which is a very old established restaurant in Paris, always serves caviar, and I assume they got it from Russia, but it became very clear that really good caviar is no longer available from Russia. There are no exports at all anymore. And then I was told by Boris, my Boris helper, that in fact a lot of the caviar served in the really good Parisian restaurants is French caviar. But in many cases, it's been re-exported to Russia and then brought back into France in Russian cans so as to have the necessary sort of frisson for people here. So we went down to the Prunier farm where they grow the sturgeon and harvest the caviar, and they very kindly showed us around and gave us an insight into how it's produced. And when we tasted it, of course, I realized that it's just as good as Russian caviar, perhaps even better because it's fresher. And a little lighter, I think, but it's still wonderful stuff. Really, I wonder how I got along without it so long.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with John Baxter about his new book, The Perfect Meal. Let's go on the phone now to Max, calling from Duncanville. Hi, Max.
Hello. I was wondering if you could describe the late president. I think Mitterrand. Yes. Terminal cancer, and I heard he had one tremendous meal, his last meal, and ate nothing more until he died.
Do you know anything about Mitterrand's last meal?
Yes, it's an extraordinary feast. He was dying. He was long dying and fending off his death. And he decided to invite a group of close friends to an enormous feast at which he served all of his favorites. The thing that attracted a lot of attention is that these favorites included a tiny bird called the ortolan. In fact, it's illegal to kill or trap the ortolan. And they're tiny little birds, members of the finch family. They're about the size of your thumb. And the way they're a great delicacy because the way they're cooked is that they're trapped alive, they're drowned in Armagnac, and then the feathers are taken off and they're cooked in a closed container called a costelette, and then you eat the whole thing. You eat the head, you eat the bones, you eat everything,
and with a napkin draped over your whole head.
Well, that's right. That's the ultimate distinction. The aroma is so rich that you drape your napkin over your head so as you eat it, so as not to miss even the slightest part of the bouquet. And Mitterrand ate three or four of these and were among the last things that he ever ate. I have to say I have never eaten ortolan. I'm not sure I could if I was faced with it. I have to say some part of me wishes that I could try it just to see if it really is as remarkable as people say.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Y'all are making me hungry.
Good.
What I wanted to say is I went to a cooking school about 20 years ago, and the gentleman who was the instructor spoke of a meal that one could have in Paris, and it was kind of mysterious. He said you have to pay in advance and wait for months, but once you got there, the waiters were like ghosts, and everything appeared, and it was the most fabulous thing one could have in one's life, and you must do it. Could you speak of that, John?
I think this is he's talking about a restaurant called Arpège. This is the restaurant of Alain Passard, who is one of the greatest chefs in France. Arpège gets 19.5 stars in the Gomio food guide, and no one gets 20. It's a tiny restaurant almost opposite the Musée Rodin up by the Invalides. It has about 12 tables. It's absolutely perfect. The walls are of pear wood. The lighting sconces are by René Lalique. They've been taken from a carriage on the old Orient Express. Dinner will cost you about $500 to $1,000 per person. And that's if you don't order too radically on the wine list. Every dish is brought to you separately under a cover, and as it's placed in front of you, your waiter leans down and says, "Ah, now this is your roasted whatever it is, you know," and then whisks away the lid, and the results are quite extraordinary, even more so because over the last few years, Passard has removed meat from his cooking. So now all these dishes are vegetarian. And some of them are remarkable. I ate there not too long ago, and I remember two white beets baked in a salt crust, which was quite remarkable. There was a little, he has what they call an amuse-gueule, a sort of, I don't know, not appetizer exactly, a little something to kind of refine the tongue. And what it is he takes an ordinary soft-boiled egg. He takes out a little of the white, which is still very soft and runny. He puts in a little cream and just a few drops of maple syrup. And you would not think that a soft-boiled egg and maple syrup would go together. In fact, it's an extraordinary combination. He also does a dessert called Tomato du Saveur, tomato of the 12 flavors, where they take a tomato and they poach it all through the day in a syrup which has 12 different spices in it. And the tomato contracts and contracts until it's quite hard and chewy, almost like a plum. And the sauces become very thick, kind of the thickness of varnish. And this is served, the tomato, a little pool of this sauce, and a little spindle of what looks like vanilla ice cream, but is in fact anise ice cream. There are no words to convey the sense that you get of the flavors in these dishes. Passard is absolutely extraordinary, and though it seems like a lot of money to spend for a meal, I think it's worth every centime.
Well, it's interesting, John, when you talk about the menu they're converting to vegetarian, because that is not what happened when Paris was under siege in 1870.
No, that's certainly not true. They ate everything. The Germans had ringed Paris and kept everybody in and allowed nobody in or out. So the French ate all the regular animals. Then they ate the domestic animals, so there were no dogs or cats left. And then the staff of the zoo found that it was no longer possible to feed their animals, and so, with much regret, it has to be said, they put them up for sale as livestock, which meant that almost all the animals were sold to butchers. Some were avoided. For instance, nobody could think how to cook hippopotamus, and nobody wanted to eat the monkeys because the Origin of Species of Darwin had come out a few years before, and I think people were starting to realize that the chimpanzee was, you know, they're sort of closely related on both sides of their family. But things like the yak, for instance, sold very well because it's basically just like a buffalo. And then also they sold the elephants. The trunks were apparently very tender, and they were bought by one of the best restaurants in Paris, Voisin. And the chef there prepared various dishes using the zoo animals. And then for the 100th day of the siege, as a sort of, cocking a snook, as we say, making a kind of defiant gesture, one finger up, you would say, I suppose, at the Germans, prepared this sumptuous feast made up entirely of animals from the zoo. And it became so famous that for years afterwards, if you were a valued guest at Voisin, you would be presented with a copy of the menu for that meal. No one will ever eat a meal like that again. It's one of those hallmarks, I think, landmarks, I should say, in the history of cuisine.
I'm going to read, because I have it in front of me here, some of the items that were on this menu. Kangaroo stew, which must bother you as an Australian.
No, I have actually eaten kangaroo stew.
Have you really?
Yeah, well, kangaroo is not bad. It's a bit chewy. It's a bit like venison, but if it's cooked well, it's quite good. There was actually a chef in France for a long time, Jean-Claude Brunetto, who had a little restaurant where kangaroo steak was the specialty, and it was delicious. But I'm sorry I interrupted you. Please go on.
Oh, it's all right. Haunch of wolf with venison sauce, cat flanked by rats. It's hard to imagine. I mean, did people actually taste all these foods, or were they sort of there to see and be seen?
I'm a bit dubious about cat flanked by rats, to tell you the truth. Rats were certainly eaten. Rats are still eaten in China. They taste like duck, I'm told. But I have a feeling that this might have been like something molded in an aspic, or it might have been a kind of pastry of some sort filled with a pate of some kind. It isn't as exotic as the other dishes, which, as you say, there's camel, kangaroo, wolf, and so on.
Why do the French not care much for cake?
Yes, odd that. I think it's because they don't like crumbs. Mm-hmm. They're very, you know, the French, of the Parisians particularly, very fastidious when it comes to clothes. You do not see people with gravy stains on the fronts of their shirts. Everybody is very careful like that. The traditional image of a Frenchman eating his lunch is, as you know, he has his napkin tucked into the collar of his jacket and spread out across the front of his shirt to avoid any splashes. But crumbs will fall if you're eating a croissant or a cake. So the French avoid them. They tend to like patisserie, which is a bit moist. So there are various sorts of pastries, the financier, the cannelle, which have usually almond flour mixed into them, and they might have an addition of a little rum or something, some liqueur, the effect of which is to prevent crumbs from falling. But what is really worth watching is a Frenchman eating a croissant.
Let me jump in, because we have to take a quick break, and I do want to hear you describe this. My guest is author John Baxter. His new book is called The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are speaking this hour with John Baxter, author of the new book, The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, John, obviously you mentioned many items of pastry that are not so crummy. It's hard to argue that a very flaky croissant doesn't make a mess. So how does one eat a croissant without getting flakes of delicious dough all over yourself?
It's an art. I learned it by watching French men and women in cafes. You know, to if you go into a cafe, to show that you are really a local, somebody very familiar with the area, you don't sit at a table. You stand at the bar, what they call the zinc, for the zinc facing that used to be used on these. And then you eat your croissant and your coffee standing up. That's the first thing. Then if you look at them, they take the croissant and without sort of interrupting their conversation, they hold it away from themselves and break it in half. The crumbs fall on the floor. Then they take it and they dunk it. If they're drinking a café crème, they dunk it into the coffee, just a little, just enough to moisten the edge, so that if there are any remaining flakes, they don't fall onto their jacket or coat. And then as they eat it, they lean forward a little, so even then, if there's anything falls, it'll fall onto the zank or into the saucer. And they invariably escape the crumbs down the front, which for the rest of us are a sort of a risque du métier of eating a croissant.
So, of course, you had to go on a search for something like the Madeleines that inspired Marcel Proust. First of all, talk about what you found at his hometown and what you ultimately discovered about this story.
Oh, yes, this was fascinating. I asked my daughter, she's now 22, whether she would like to go with me to Illiers-Combray to visit Proust. Childhood home and maybe even eat the Madeleine that is such a famous part of his novel In Search of Lost Time, because as you know the whole idea of the novel spins off a memory he has of his childhood, which is triggered by tasting a little crumb of Madeleine in some tea. So Louise, our daughter, and I, we went to Illiers, which I have to say was a real surprise. I thought it would be filled with Proust tea shops and ye little oldie Madeleine restaurants. In fact, as far as the people of Illiers are concerned, Proust was nothing special. There's nothing. There's no monument, no statue. There's a tiny little information office, and that's about it. There's the house where Proust lived when he was a boy, and opposite was a patisserie that said, "This is where Proust's Tante Léonie used to buy the Madeleines," but it was closed, and the house, which is now a museum, was getting ready to close for a 2.5-hour lunch break, which I thought was excessive. But anyway, we waited around and we looked over the house, which is extraordinary. And then by then the patisserie was open, so we bought some Madeleines. And when we were heading back on the train, Louise said to me, "You know, it wasn't actually a Madeleine." And I said, "How do you mean it wasn't a Madeleine?" She said, "Well, what he dunked in the tea, it wasn't a Madeleine." And I said, "Of course it was a Madeleine. Everybody knows Proust and the Madeleine. You know, it's famous." And she said, "No. In fact, that's what he put into the novel. But what really happened, he describes in an earlier book called Contre Sainte-Beuve." And she said, she quoted it to him. He said, "You know, he came in one night and his housekeeper brought up a cup of tea and some pain gruyère, which is toast. And he dunked the toast in the tea, and that's what gave him the idea." And I thought, not a Madeleine. but I always knew, I grew up, you know, everybody thinks it's a Madeleine. She said, "Well, no, it's not." So I thought, well, there's another dream sort of destroyed. But it was an extraordinary experience, you know, to learn this on the train back from having made this kind of pilgrimage to the what I thought was the fount of all this wonderful writing. I don't suppose it makes the, you know, it doesn't invalidate the wonderful novel, but it does make you realize that you can't rely on novelists, I think.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It is. I sort of read that and thought, sad trombone. You know, you've gone to all this trouble and you could have probably made some toast at home.
Well, exactly. But then, you know, we had the fun of doing it and I had the fun of writing about it. So I can't complain.
Is there such a thing, John, as a mediocre truffle?
Well, yes, actually there is, because there are truffles coming from China now, which are not very distinguished. You can buy them in little jars very cheaply. They're not great. But if you talk about a genuine grown in the ground truffle that's matured for a couple of seasons and grown to a reasonable size, which is harvested without it being nibbled by dogs or pigs or whatever, and then is prepared and presented correctly. I don't think there can be a truffle. I never met a truffle I didn't like. I particularly love the white truffles of Italy. As I describe in the book, we my wife and I spent some time not long ago working on a TV project that took us to Florence and Rome quite a lot, and we got used to eating these really delicious little soft rolls that you can buy in Florence, which are spread with butter mixed with white truffle. And we used to travel back to Paris on the overnight train, and we'd always take a dozen of these and a bottle of champagne. And as we were sort of rolling through the Italian countryside under the moon, eating truffles and drinking champagne, I thought, yes, this is what they talk. This is what they mean when they say the good life.
So what did you find when you went to investigate the origins of steak tartare, which I think a lot of Americans imagine is a classic French dish?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? It's certainly regarded as a classic French dish by the French. It's one of the basic lunch dishes. I suppose it's like French onion soup. You know, it's something that every restaurant would offer. And I always thought it had to be originally French. You know, it's a piece of lean fillet steak that's, if you go with the purists, has been chopped up very finely with two very sharp knives, and then it's mixed with usually a raw egg yolk, some capers, a little chopped onion, some parsley, salt and pepper, and that's it. Maybe with a little chopped pickle on the side, something like that. And I'd eaten hundreds. And then I started to look for its where it came from, thinking maybe it's a regional specialty, so I could go to the place where the tartare was invented and eat it, you know, in the actual surroundings. But I found that there was no record of it before about 1920. It just didn't exist. It's not in Escoffier. It's not in any of these. But what is in Escoffier is something called steak American, American steak. And I thought, I know what happened. I can imagine some American soldiers over in Paris during the war trying to explain to a chef and a waiter that spoke no English that what they wanted was minced beef with egg and onion, in other words, a hamburger, with a pickle, maybe. and the waiter explaining this to the chef, and the chef not understanding that you were supposed to cook it. And so serving them the raw beef with an egg to bind it and some onion and a pickle, and wondering why they were so surprised. But then maybe tasting it himself and thinking,
Not bad.
This isn't bad.
So where did you finally go to get your roasted ox?
That was extraordinary. People are roasting whole animals all over France. For my mother-in-law's 80th birthday, we actually had a man come in and roast a lamb. But roasting an ox is a bigger order, because you're talking about 1,000 pounds of meat. So you've got to think about 500 people to eat it. And there's an association of beef growers that periodically arrange an ox roast, but that you have to do it in a place where you can guarantee 500 people, which means also you have to have a tent, you have to have the equipment to roast it. It's a major project. And fortunately, we found an ox roast that was going to take place up in Picardy, which is right up in northern France along the Belgian border. And so we drove up one night and watched the whole ceremony, the preparation of the fire pit with the white hot coals, the rolling in of this enormous animal, the roasting over hours and hours, and then it was taken off the spit and taken down to the butchers who cut off the cooked portions and then butchered the rest to be grilled as steaks. And then we all went into this tent, 500 of us, and we ate this animal down until there was nothing left but the bare bones. And I have to say it was a dizzying experience.
And I guess you're sitting with people that you may not necessarily know, and just do you strike up a conversation?
Well, yes, it was great. The man next to me noticed that I was taking notes, and he said, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Well, I'm a writer, and I'm doing a book about this." And he kind of looked at me. You know, he'd never seen a writer before. I mean, this was in a village of 900 people called Boonicore. They hardly ever saw foreigners, at least of all writers. So he, in fact, was Portuguese, though he'd lived there for a long time. And we chatted, and he said, "Listen, you should be out, talking to the butchers." And I said, "Well, I don't want to interrupt them." He said, no, they would love this." So he took me out, and he introduced me to these dozen butchers who were cutting up the carcass and feeding it to the barbecues to make steak. And he introduced me, and he said, "This man's from Australia." And immediately they were fascinated because they wanted to know about kangaroo. And so we were standing around talking about meat, which I thought was very appropriate in the circumstances. Then he led me back inside, and we sat down and we ate this meal. And it was wonderful. You know, I grew up in an Australian country town. I'm used to these sort of ceremonies, these, you know, church hall dinners and dances and talent. I suppose it's the same in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great time. It was very moving. It was, you really felt in touch with the really essential French culture that you just don't see in Paris.
Can you tell us about the menu that you finally assembled for yourself, even if you didn't have intentions of cooking the whole thing at one time?
Well, in fact, somebody is actually going to cook a shortened version of the menu at a restaurant in Paris. I think it's next week or the week after. Four or five dishes from the menu. Yes, I thought, what would if I had my druthers? You know, if I could serve the perfect meal that I talked about, what would it be? So I assembled the dishes that I'd tasted, that I'd tried. I tried to think of ways of making them workable for somebody who might be cooking this in their home. I think it's a very workable menu. It includes a version of bouillabaisse. It includes bœuf bourguignon, beef cooked in Burgundy, which is a classic dish. It includes a delicious sort of parfait invented by our friend in Bergerac, which uses fresh berries and a mixture of mascarpone cheese, yogurt and cream and lemon, which is a real discovery. It includes some great wines. It includes a Kia Royale Florian, which is a mixture of champagne with a lychee liqueur and a tiny spoonful of preserved rose leaves from a particular confiserie down in Provence. I'd like to cook the whole meal one of these days, to tell you the truth. But for the moment, I have my memories.
John Baxter's new book is called The Perfect Meal, In Search of the Lost Tastes of France. John, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email them to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.